From the Wall Street Journal, this is Instant Message. I'm David Pierce. This week on the show, apparently we're all sick. I'm also in my hotel room in Las Vegas, where the CES Tech Show has taken over the entire Vegas Strip. We're going to talk about the biggest stories here and whether Joanna, who's usually here, feels terrible about not coming this year. And just a pro tip, if she says she doesn't, don't worry, she's lying. We're also going to give you a couple of tips to help you be better at email. And later, I'm going to chat with Tony Ho, an executive at Segway Ninebot, the company that makes virtually all the scooters you're seeing on city streets everywhere. But first, let's follow up on a story we talked about last week. After Apple told investors to expect a slowdown in smartphone sales, Samsung and LG followed up by saying basically the same thing. So is the smartphone era starting to slow down, or is it over? Here with me to talk about that and everything else, as always, Joanna Stern in New York and Christopher Mims in Baltimore. Hey guys, how you feeling?
Good. Actually not good. Pretending to
I'm the only
good.
One who's not sick.
And you get to hide from the sickness that is capturing all of us. That's the beauty of moving to Baltimore.
Oh yeah, it's like a plague out there.
So Joanna, you wrote a piece this week about the iPhone XR, which you've now written about a couple of times. And we also reported this week that that is the phone that Apple's really having a hard time selling. But the three of us and most other critics and reviewers really like that phone. So what's going on? Explain to the world what the problem is with the XR here, Joanna.
Our colleagues here at the Journal reported that Apple took a big bet on the XR. They produced many, many of these phones, hoping especially to sell in China, and it has not been as successful as they've wanted it to be. It's not that Apple isn't selling any of these. It's just that Apple has, according to our reports, reduced production of the phone because of the lagging sales. And again, we don't have any details on sales of the XR versus the XS, but presumably Apple thought they would sell a lot of these XRs all over the world, and they're just not selling as many. And as a result, now they've dropped the price significantly, or at least dropped the price if you trade in your old phone. So the phone starts at $749, and you can get it for as little as $450 if you trade in your phone.
So, and this was, wait, just to stop you real quick, it seems like, so Apple's made these like sort of one-off phones before, right? There was like the 5C and the SE and stuff. And it always seemed like those were not necessarily phones Apple expected to sell tons and tons and tons of. But I get the sense they were trying to sell tons and tons and tons of the XR.
I mean, I think Apple thought they had a major hit on its hands. I actually think they do in terms of a product. Like, this is my main phone now. I love it. As I say in this piece, it's the most reliable iPhone I've ever had. The battery life is like off the charts. I just don't worry about battery life anymore. The screen is fine. Sure, it doesn't have the OLED screen of the 10 and the 10, I mean the 10S and the 10S Max. Whatever. The camera doesn't have a second camera. Still great. Like, this is a great phone for the $750. Like, that's my opinion. And I think Apple thought that too. And as I talk about in this piece, I think they had a number of things going against them here. Number one being what we talked about on last week's show, which is that people already have great phones. And in the last quarter, they gave people even more reason to hold on to their phones. And that was iOS 12, the battery upgrade program. So people just weren't upgrading. My second theory is really, it really comes down to marketing, I think, is that this phone gets lost in the shuffle. It's this like middle child that you're not really sure why I'd get this middle phone here if I should get this better, more expensive, great phone, the XS, or I should get the cheaper iPhone 8 or iPhone 7 or even iPhone 6S, which is still available some places. So they frankly just have done a really bad job marketing the phone. I don't know if anyone's seen the ads, but they're just like people running around in colored suits. I don't know why they're running around. They're just like, it doesn't tell you anything about the phone. So those are my two leading theories about why people are not buying this phone as much.
Christopher, what do you make of all of this?
I mean, there's this general phone slump. It wasn't just Apple who had to adjust their numbers, right, for this quarter. Right on the heels of that, Samsung's chip division was like, there's soft demand for our phones. It's entirely possible that the non-success of the XR doesn't tell us anything other than people are not buying phones, period. So I don't want to overinterpret it. And I think it really does seem like we have reached peak smartphone.
Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting to see Apple and Samsung all say things about how they're not selling smartphones at the same volume anymore, while also here at CES, like, desperately trying to find something else and even doing things that are sort of out of character for these companies, because they seem to realize, like, oh God, we've had a decade of this impossible cash cow where just everyone kept buying them, and it seemed like that was never going to end, and then all of a sudden it ended, and they're all sort of scrambling to figure out, like, oh crap, okay, what's the next thing we can sell everybody once a year for the next decade? And I don't know if it's going to be quite that obvious this time around.
Yeah, and I think actually that's like the irony of this 10R is like, I don't want to say that it's the perfect smartphone in the world. Like, there's nothing Apple can do to make it better, but it really addresses like most of the complaints I've had about smartphones for the last 5 years. And so if someone buys this phone, or like I bought this phone, and I mean, I will probably upgrade next year just because of who I am, but other normal people who buy this phone likely will not have to upgrade for years. Like, if this holds up and, you know, the glass doesn't crack on the back, the front you can replace, the back is very slippery and you could very easily crack it. Like, I can't see a reason why you'd want to get a new phone in 3 or 4 years. I mean, maybe 5G.
It sounds like the Honda Civic of phones. Like, yeah, you could buy it and it's going to be awesome for you, and it's a nice little commuter, and it's going to go to 100,000 miles.
I think that, I mean, other than like some small, like big upgrade that will be small in terms of like looks and feel to the phone, like 5G, for instance, like that may be the next big thing that people are like, I need 5G in my phone, so I'm going to go get this thing. It's really hard to imagine that people will be running to go replace a 10R in the next 3 to 4 years.
It's not going to be 5G, according to the excellent reporting in the Wall Street Journal.
It's a mess. It's all we've been talking about all week at CES. People just sort of wander the halls aimlessly being like, what is 5G? And nobody has a good answer. Just, or like, that's literally all we've been doing all week, is just trying to figure out what in the world people are talking about when they talk about 5G.
It's Wi-Fi hotspots rebranded as 5G.
Yeah, basically. Let's switch gears and let's talk about CES, actually. So CES is, for anyone who doesn't know, it's the biggest tech show in the world. And basically every company on the planet comes to Vegas to show off all the products they're going to have this year. I'm the only one who's actually here of the three of us. You're welcome, you guys. It's cold and crowded, and everybody here, I think, is sick. But sometimes I actually want you guys to lead me here, because I feel like it's hard to know what from the show is making it outside of Vegas. So Joanna, lead me wherever you want here. What do you want to know about CES?
Lead you in the middle of the street where you can get 5G and get run over by a self-driving car.
But it'll be so fast,
and there'll be connectivity everywhere. First, thank you, David. Thank you for taking one for the team and for covering the show for us this week. We are so thankful to you. My first question is, what did you eat this week?
We actually ate really well this week. My big promise to the team coming here was that I will not do what apparently you, Joanna, do to everybody, which is just make them go to Sbarro over and over and over.
Yeah.
And also, they closed the Sbarro at the Las Vegas Convention Center, which was a very big deal, and everybody was very upset about it. So we mostly ate, you know, normal Vegas food. I ate the new Impossible Burger, which was pretty exciting. They had an event here and made a big deal about how they were the first food technology to ever be at CES. So I ate that.
You ate the burger, right?
Yeah, so they actually had, let's see, they had burgers, empanadas, tacos, and tartare for the new meat, and they were basically serving them all sort of tapas style to us during this event, and so I got to try all of them.
Did the burger
taste
rubbery?
Are there any Soylent clones roving the floors?
Strangely, no. Actually, I feel like that's one of the things I look for every year now, is the sort of weird ideas about how people cannot eat food. And it seems like that's kind of gone away. The Impossible Foods event was huge. They were in this room in a restaurant, and it was like spilling out the doors with the crowds. But in general, people were, you know, just sadly eating their press box lunches and dealing with it.
Did you try the bread from the bread bot? Did you see the bread bot?
I did see the bread bot. I got an email from one of our colleagues before I left with a link to the bread bot saying, bring one of these home or don't come home at all. And they're slightly too large to bring home. And so these things, which are basically these huge sort of contained bread making robots and also bread loaf vending machines that are intended to go in like grocery stores to give lots of fresh bread, they had them here and I tried the bread, and honestly, it's delicious. I mean, it's bread. And it was like, I got to point at it and be like, I want that one. And it came out, and then I had a loaf of bread. It was like wonderfully not interesting at the end of it.
What about smart home?
Yeah. So what about smart home is another one of the questions that everyone in Vegas will not stop asking, because we're at this point now where it's cheap and pretty easy to put connectivity into any device you want. And Google Assistant and Alexa are desperate to be in all kinds of devices. So they're working with everybody, and anything you can think of is here in the Vegas Convention Center, somehow connected to the internet. But I wrote this piece about virtual assistants right before CES and timed that intentionally. And the thrust of the piece was basically like, okay, it's cool that all of this is connected to the internet. It's a little scary, But in the abstract, it's a cool idea that all of our lives are going to be connected. But like, what in the world are we supposed to do with all of this stuff? And there wasn't a ton of that. Like, how is all this supposed to work together? How is it actually going to make my life easier? It's neat that I can yell at my lights to turn off, but I can also just get up and flip the switch. So like, give me something real and new and different. So it feels like this year is going to be a year where it kind of tips to like, the default option is going to start to be the connected one for a lot of things, that they're just going to be anything you want. You're going to be able to buy a connected version of it. But why you would do that is no clearer to me than it was a week ago.
What was the stupidest, coolest connected thing you saw?
Oh, man. I mean, this is sort of cheating, but it's because it's a holdover from last year also. But it's got to be the Kohler intelligent toilet, which now has Alexa inside. There was also an Alexa-enabled bed, which is just a bed with a speaker in the bottom that points out the bottom of your mattress that does Alexa things. I would love to like justify the existence of these things for you, but I can't. They're just...
I've always wanted a microphone in my bed.
Yeah, it's like, what if you were lying in bed but could talk to a robot? Could
be. Yeah.
And one of our colleagues, Katie Binley, went and saw the Alexa mattress and basically kept asking them over and over, what is better about this than if I just had a mattress and a speaker next to it? And they kept being like, well, it's in the bed. And that was it. That's the whole answer. And I feel like that was the
story. If you don't have a nightstand, or you are in a room where there is absolutely no room for putting a speaker, this is your solution. That's the only answer they really have.
Right. Your room is exactly the size of your mattress.
Save space, and you can't put this tiny little puck. You don't even have a room for a glass of water.
It's very important.
One question I had, micro-LED. You wrote this piece about how this is going to be the biggest technology to change televisions since color television. You didn't write that, but that's basically how I read it, or at least that's how I read your headline.
I'm okay with it.
Is it that great? Like, is this really like the TV technology we should all be thinking about right now?
Yes and no. So the tech is that great. Samsung had this big event right before the show started where they had a bunch of different TVs, and they were all, you know, I think the largest one was 219 inches and the smallest one was like the size of a like hardback book. But they were all made of this same technology, which is micro-LED, which is basically a different way of lighting a display panel. There's lots of technical detail, but it doesn't really matter. That is more powerful, better looking, more efficient, and doesn't degrade over time. So it's like, in theory, sort of the ideal display tech. And it's a bigger deal, I think, for its ability to do things like be modular. Like these TVs of all different sizes that Samsung had were basically just tiles. And you put a bunch together in sort of any size and configuration you want, and you can just build screens kind of ad hoc. So they had one that was maybe 6 feet tall, but not very wide, that could be sort of a like vertical window. They had the same thing horizontally, and they were using it as sort of art. And you could have your TV literally like automatically pull apart when it's off into like picture frames and then come together to show your TV. And this tech is also going to be really cool. Apple bought a company a few years ago that's doing micro LED stuff. And the rumors are that they're thinking about it for the Apple Watch and for phones. And because it's brighter, more power efficient, and just better looking in general, it's like a huge win for displays, which tend to be the biggest battery suck on pretty much all devices. So it's the sort of thing that like we are years away from being near this being a thing for regular humans. It's really expensive. It's really hard to manufacture. And everybody I talk to is like, yeah, this is going to be something for, you know, Jeff Bezos and nobody else that they can afford for the next several years. But eventually this is going to be the kind of thing that like, if all the world is going to be screens, this is a pretty big step in that direction, which I think is cool. And also, I have learned in my time as a reporter that people really, really, really care about their televisions in a way that I always forget. But people like watching TV, and a better TV continues to make people really, really happy.
I really appreciate your passion for the micro-LEDs. I've never seen anything quite like it, really.
It's tiny lights, Joanna. Millions of tiny lights. They're changing everything.
Is it one of these things like OLED where they're like, because I remember even a couple of years ago, people were saying OLED is going to be so cheap, it's going to replace regular like LED lamps. And instead of having light bulbs on your ceiling, you're going to have like a square, like a tile of OLED. and it will be the exact same color temperature as the outdoor sunshine. So it'll feel like you have a skylight. Maybe it's even drawing a blue sky up there. Like, is that, are we anywhere near that?
Yeah, there was this really neat display at the LG booth where they basically took a bunch of OLED panels and bent them into these cool shapes and used them as overhead lights. So it looked like this just amazing sort of hanging lamp demonstration. But what it actually was just a bunch of sort of gently lit OLED panels. It was very cool. I'm sure it's not cheap, but it was very cool. But the thing that I think is interesting about micro-LED is that it's what's expensive about it is not so much the technology as the manufacturing, because they're putting on millions of these tiny little lights, and the array of them and how they're put together is really, really important, because even just a couple of them being wrong can screw up the whole system. And they're actually so small in many cases that they're outside of the tolerance of even robot manufacturing. So like they just can't do it as carefully and exactly as they need to. But assuming that over the next however many years that gets better and gets figured out, like the parts itself they're not that expensive. Like that stuff is not the problem with micro LED right now. So as they get better at actually making them, I think it is the sort of thing that's going to fall in price really, really fast. And a lot of these companies are thinking about that kind of stuff you're talking about. And this is a piece of that where they're like, well, instead of selling you a 65-inch pane of glass, we can sell you lots of sort of small interchangeable things that you can move around however you want. And that's when things like lighting starts to get a lot more interesting, I think.
You are the Wall Street Journal's best ever CES reporter. I went to CES for the last 4 years while being at the Journal, last 11 years of my life. And I covered like a fork that vibrated when you ate too much, a bag that would drive around and follow you, a mirror. And you have covered such more important things in your last 3 days than I did in those 4 years.
To be clear, here are some things I also did at CES. I stood in front of a mirror that uses a camera and AI to apply makeup to your face so you can see what looks good before you buy it.
This is in our video that we just published, or David's video that he just published, and he looks beautiful. Okay. Another reason he's the best, most prettiest person to ever cover the Wall Street Journal to cover CES for the Wall Street Journal.
That sounds right. I'll take it. No, let's see. So I stood in front of a home brewing system from LG and just yelled things like, I love beer, over and over for about 45 minutes. I watched a TV roll up and down over and over for about an hour. I tried on 1,000 pairs of bad headphones and listened to 1,000 pairs of bad Bluetooth speakers. I spent like 3 hours looking around trying to find this Hyundai concept car that instead of having wheels has legs and is designed to be like a first responder thing. And I was begging people to show it to me and let me ride on it, and nobody would, and it was very sad. So it wasn't all victories.
This like hoverboard thing that's also in the video, why were you standing on that thing? Do you even know what that does?
It's supposedly, the person who was showing it off said it burns 600 calories in 10 minutes just by being on it. Yeah, and the guy who was running the booth was walking around saying he was 85, and this man was like in better shape than I am, wearing a cool trucker hat and like doing these cool exercises on top of this balancing board. So if he's really 85, then that is easily the best thing I saw at CES.
The new shake weight. That's awesome.
Basically, it turns me into the shake weight.
Everyone should just watch the video. It's a little bit uncomfortable to watch. He's just shaking in the air, and then he's talking to you. You just got to watch it.
It's 60 minutes long of just me shaking. It's great. All right. So any other burning CES questions before we move on?
Is there anything you want us to know about that you haven't told us about?
Google Assistant and Alexa really are very interested in being part of your life. Have you guys seen pictures of the Google thing here? It's nuts.
What Google thing?
It just feels like nothing.
That was actually sort of what was interesting to me about this, was there were not a ton of new ideas. It just felt very iterative over last year. It was like everybody who was doing stuff in, you know, 2016 and 2017 got a little better at it in 2018 and is going to get a little better at it in 2019. And it feels like we're still in this moment of everybody thinks augmented reality is going to be really cool, and everybody thinks virtual assistants are going to be really cool, but nobody quite knows how yet. So everybody's just kind of trying stuff in the meantime, which is a little weird to watch, but it makes CES kind of fun.
Yeah. Like, was there anything that you saw that a virtual assistant did that was like better than play music, tell you the weather, turn on a light?
No. IKEA has smart blinds, which I'm excited about. I feel like IKEA is sort of the quiet but most important company and virtual assistants right now. Like, my house is mostly IKEA stuff. And if that stuff started to be connected, all of a sudden I'd be like accidentally have a smart home just because I keep going to IKEA for things. So the fact that they're bought into this is pretty exciting. But other than that, it was like, it's all sort of the same stuff. There's going to be a time where somebody starts to figure out how all of this stuff is supposed to work together, and we're just not there yet. It was a very interesting CES, I have to say. A lot of big TVs.
It's awaiting you in 2020.
So before we get to Segway's Tony Ho on scooters, self-driving cars, and how we'll all get around in the future, Christopher, I've been seeing you tweet a bunch recently about how you manage your email, and I feel like you're good at email, and as both of you know, I am horrendous at email. So since we're still early in 2019 and people are still trying to, you know, do better this year, give us a couple of tips on how you think people can be better at email.
My thing with email is as much about just focusing on the channels that matter to you. So it doesn't have to be email, but I have just decided, you know, because of the demographics of the people I'm communicating with, email is mine. So I've really narrowed it down to email and then WhatsApp for group chats and everything else I'm trying to ignore or eliminate, whether that's social media or Facebook Messenger or Twitter DMs or whatever. And I just find that when I focus, you know, email is this incredibly powerful tool that we undervalue at our peril. So to give you one example, people always say, oh, you know, why isn't Google good at social? Like, why was Google Plus so bad? How come Google's never done a decent social product? They just don't understand how people think. I actually think that's wrong. I think Gmail is the greatest social tool ever invented by humankind. And we just don't use it enough. Like, it keeps getting better. It keeps sorting our mail better. Now it's bubbling up old messages that we should act on. And because email is just a more thoughtful channel, it ends up being a more meaningful, a higher bandwidth way for me to communicate with people one-on-one, which is what we should all be doing more anyway. Like, what do we care about the validation of thousands of strangers, except of course that as journalists our livelihoods depend on it. I mean, I just think that it is one of the few open standards we have left. It is a push medium that we have a ton of control over. There's no master algorithm defining what we see there. Email newsletters have made a resurgence. So it's a more thoughtful communication medium than ever. And I think that is a direct response to people getting burned out on social media.
I have a question for you. So we all get a lot of email. What's your best way of triaging? What's your best way? And you mentioned Gmail. What's your best way of seeing what messages come into Gmail and not forgetting to respond or deal with the most important ones?
I mean, step one is just consigning most of it to the archives immediately.
The stuff you don't want.
What's that?
The bad stuff, archive right away.
Yeah, all the spam. Step two is that I am going to whatever's left that's a thread. You know, there's going to be a time of the day or even a time of the week where I might respond briefly and be like, hey, I'm putting this on ice for a little while, or I'm dealing with it right then. And I think, you know, David, I think you're the one who said on Twitter, you know, you should not ever say, oh, I'm sorry, it took me so long to get back to you. I think that's part of it. It's just we have to sort of relieve ourselves of this mental burden that we need to get back to people right away or on any particular timetable. And that just feels more natural in email because it is a slower medium. Like, if it takes you a week to get back to someone's text, they wonder if you're dead. But like over email, we all understand that we've got a lot going on. And so the sort of beauty of it is you don't have to be perfect at it, and you can let things slip through the cracks, and that's fine. You know, we all have limited time and attention. And if we're all doing our level best to make the best use of our time, if there's stuff we don't get to, we don't get to it. That's fine. Let it pile up. Who cares? Just move on to the next thing. If people really want your attention, they'll bubble it back up again because they need it.
Right. And Gmail will remind you now that, like, I actually really appreciate this, the feature, right? Like, that reminds you, you haven't responded to this message, or this person hasn't responded to your message in 5 days or whatever it says. Do you want to bother them again? Or it'll say the same thing to you. You haven't responded to this thing. Do you want to respond to it?
And I think the key is just limiting the number of channels, right? Like, if my channels are iMessage, WhatsApp, and email, that's about as much as I can handle, you know. But if I also had to deal with Slack messages piling up and, you know, three other chat apps, that I think that's when we really get lost.
I like it. My only useful tip is muting threads all the time. Like, I've gotten really good at, like, anytime I see a thread starting to happen that I am not interested in, I just immediately mute it. And then however many stupid reply alls go in there, I don't have to see them ever again. And it is delightful. I don't know how many emails I've missed because I don't see them. And I'm sure it's a lot.
To be fair, those are any emails that or chains that I'm on.
Yeah, anything from Joanna just instantly gets muted, and it has really made my email a lot better. All right, so we should move on. Coming up in a second, my interview with Segway's Tony Ho on the future of the scooter business and how we'll all travel in the future.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Plus, save time by completing security questionnaires with Vanta AI. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ. That's VANTA.com/WSJ.
Welcome back. I suspect one of the biggest tech stories of 2019 is going to be what happens to the companies that are putting those dockless, shareable devices on city streets all over the place. The scooter companies. There's Bird and Lime and Scoot and Skip and Jump and Wind and probably like 100 others I'm forgetting. But most of these companies have one thing in common. Their scooters are made by Segway. Yeah, that Segway. The ones that made the silly-looking rideable thing that was supposed to take over the world but is now mostly for, I don't know, mall cops and city tours. The company's been thinking about this problem of how people move around in the world for a really long time. It's been through a number of owners in the last few years, recently landing with a Chinese company called Ninebot. And they became the default option for all these scooter companies, while also spending time thinking about things like go-karts and roller skates and hoverboards and who knows what else. I sat down with Tony Ho, Ninebot Segway's Vice President of Global Business Development, in a crowded coffee shop at CES to see what he's thinking about the future of personal transportation. But first, I asked him a question I've been dying to know. Why, of all the vehicle options on the planet, did scooters become so huge?
It's essentially two wheels with a piece of board and maybe a handlebar.
Yeah, fair.
And you can't get any simpler than that, right? Other than that, maybe a skateboard and stuff. But in terms of user-friendliness and sort of the ultimate form factor, and if you look at a kid, when the first vehicle they learn, typically is not a bicycle, it's actually a scooter. So we sort of drove to the conclusion that, you know, this is sort of ultimately the best thing. If you think about bicycles or, you know, any sort of the short distance transportation, you know, storage is always an issue and portability is always an issue. And so we go back to this question again, you know, what's the ultimate form of this? It's something you can just fold nicely. And one of the things we talk about is, what if you want to fold it down and put that in a trunk, right? So it's a perfect solution if you drive a car. Let's say you're stuck in the traffic. You park the car in the parking lot, and then you can just get to your destination, you know, while other people are stuck in the traffic.
I think it was here a year or so ago that one of the car companies had like a scooter that was in a compartment in the trunk that you could just pull out and drive to wherever you're
going. Right. So that idea has been there for the longest time. Probably 10, 20 years ago, there were already people thinking about electric. In fact, we were actually even thinking about electric Segway to put in the trunk of a car. But the problem is the original Segway was too big. So, and it's heavy, and you kind of have to lift it up, and so not to mention expensive. So it's not necessarily the idea is not there. It's just the execution of it, right?
Sure.
So for us, 3 or 4 years ago, and we say, okay, let's make something. And we actually observed that in China, there's these like designated drivers. And in the evening, when you come out of the bar, you're not supposed to drive, right?
Right.
So, and also the policeman is cracking down on drunken driving a lot. So these designated drivers will drive your car home, and they get paid to drive your car. And then they put the scooters in your car trunk while they're driving your car. So by the time they drop you off, they can ride the scooter back home. So this is actually pretty popular in Asia.
So instead of taking a cab home, they actually will drive you home and then they scooter back.
Right, okay. Right. So things like that actually sort of, you know, we start to believe that, you know, this form factor is actually the right form factor. And people actually use that tool to do a job, which is really get from point A to point B, but it needs to be compact enough. And it probably needs to be powered.
I was going to say, right. Is it important that it's electric?
Like yes.
From the beginning, you decided
very,
that was...
Very, very important, okay. Yeah. I think the difference between the bicycles and manual scooter is that bicycle is probably a lot more efficient to get around and
sure.
For different terrain. And kicking all the way for like 5 or 6 kilometers probably still pretty long distance.
Yeah, it's a hike. Right? Yeah, true. Right.
So, but with electric power, that seems to become not a major issue anymore. The scooter is a lot more adaptable. Like bicycles, you still have to adjust the heights. the handlebar sometimes, right? But for you have different, so many different sizes. But scooters, essentially, there's only one or two sizes, and one size fit all. And either way, you can just, you're standing there. There's nothing you can you need to do.
So you're making this scooter, and you decide like the scooter seems like the right form factor. Let's start to figure out how to do it. Does at some point somebody start to call you about like, hey, we're thinking about putting a bunch of scooters on the streets. Can you help us with that?
One of the advantage we had is being in China helped in the sense that China had a head start in terms of the bicycle sharing.
Yeah.
So we actually see the movie before and how the Ofo and mobike company came about, user behavior in terms of how people use it, abuse it. So we kind of see that coming. But I think the issue here, we're dealing with more than just the bicycle manual stuff. We're dealing with electric stuff, right? So obviously a lot of these things, we want to make sure maybe it's even bulletproof or, now it's definitely waterproof. But, if people throw them off the building, and it needs to protect something like the battery and those things. So that's why we kind of over-engineer a lot of the stuff, and it's going to be quite a beast, if you will.
Yeah. So this is the 2.0 of the scooter.
Share scooters, okay. Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
So the ones everybody have been riding, is that, are those roughly similar to the ones you were selling in stores before that you just kind of started selling to the scooter manufacturers or the scooter ride-sharing companies?
The one before? Or
Yeah, like the first version, the ones that I think, the first like I've version, ridden lots of those scooters. Is
yeah.
that kind of the first one? That you
exactly. They are all retail scooters.
Okay.
So if you don't put outdoors for a long time and you only ride it once or twice a day, it probably will last you a couple of years, and just like any consumer electronics company product. But if you subject that to all the hot and cold and rain, then it definitely needs to be tougher.
Okay.
And also there's a lot of the factors we don't consider before, for example, operational efficiency, right? So we know the scooter sharing company, they have to charge their scooters. So in this case, we have a really beefy battery, so it definitely lasts you quite a long time. The product itself has a lot of features, like it's more reliable, and also all these anti-theft features.
Are Bird and Lime sort of helping in the product development with this stuff?
That helped tremendously. And so sometimes it's a trade-off. So you can't satisfy the need for every single person, but it's pretty common theme across.
Like, they need to be tougher, they need to last longer.
The ride needs to be a little more comfortable, mm-hmm. right? So in this case, we actually have a nice, much better design wheels and fatter wheels and, better shock and all these things. So the ride experience can be adaptable to many different type of terrain, right? They want an out of the box is definitely one thing. I don't want to go through my own factories or warehouses. I just want to, ship them over and drop it off on the street. They can on the ground
sure.
running.
Yeah.
Right? So that's the sort of efficiency part. And to them is also competitiveness, because you get your vehicle ahead of your competitors, that means you will get that user, right? Safety, reliability wise, and all the bearings and brakes, and now they're sealed, they're kind of protected from dirt and water. They're much safer if you do that, and also last much longer mm-hmm. as well. So we'll see the life of these scooters probably significantly increase over time. So that's more return on your investment.
Okay, that makes sense. So, and then as you think about the rest of what Segway is up to, obviously you make lots of other products. You have the Drift roller skates and like tons of other things, but again, as you're saying, they're all kind of in this same sort of last mile category. Has what's happened with scooters changed the way you think about Segway as a whole? Like, have your thoughts about how this stuff works changed over the last couple of years?
In principle, it hasn't changed much, because if you even look at the model of the company, it has always been like simplifying moving. So we're about simplifying moving things and simplify moving people, and especially the last mile solutions. In the case of a robot, especially we're talking about a delivery robot, it's not even a mile. It's talking about within a building, maybe 200 yards top. The idea is still the same. We're simplifying people's life, mobility. It just happened that the scooter market exploded, and then so we kind of riding that wave now, and we kind of use that to let the consumer pick which form factor will ultimately win. So I think midterm, short term, definitely we will lean more towards on the scooter side, because we just think that's sort of what the consumer pick. But I think what we're doing now is they all have synergies. For example, robotics, we're leveraging a lot of the robotics technology today, even inside the scooters, like the sensor technology, the drivetrain, even the remote sensing technology, even talking about obstacle avoidance and cameras and gyros and those things, they are common to a lot of the different products. If you think about what Segway is, it's such a very small, compact form of a drive. With two wheels, you just pop in anything, it becomes an engine.
Right.
Right. and it's green and it's all the good stuff. You could potentially use it for many, many different things. Even the e-skates, the Drift W1, essentially we just shrunk the Segway into two, in fact. So in a way, we're still driving down the same kind of direction, but packing in more smarts, more know-hows, and also the benefit, you know, as the industry, you know, evolve, and we start to pack those benefit into the sort of the smaller package, if you will.
It's really interesting. I mean, it seems like we're in this phase where for a long time there were lots of different form factors. You have things like you have skateboards, like you were saying, and you have the one wheels, and the hoverboards were a craze for a minute, and you have Segways, and then there were scooters, and then scooters sort of took off ahead of the rest of the pack, but it doesn't necessarily feel like that's the only sort of possible one that can really work. I mean, do you feel like is this sort of experimentation of lots of different form factors going to go on for a long time, or do you think we end up settling on?
I totally think it's only the beginning. I think 2018 is the year of scooters. But if you think about scooters, has its own limitation, right? So somebody just had this use this the phrase, you know, winter is coming.
Yeah.
But literally, winter is coming,
literally
because
winter.
If you go winter, colder weather, scooters just not equipped to do that. And plus, a lot of people don't want to ride it; it's just too cold, right? So how do you solve the same last mile problem, but by addressing more demographics? Right. So one of the things you might see we demonstrate, and in fact the booth will have a video concept showing that we have these pods concept where you have a very small footprint of a product, but it's in a bubble, right? So the bubble can be climatized and you can just go about and it's ride like a mini car.
And are you thinking about things like, I don't know, self-driving and sort of how much smarter and more autonomous you can make these kinds of vehicles? Is that stuff interesting to you too?
I mean, that's one of the reasons we talk about, you know, the synergy between Segway Robotics and also these in the automobility side of the business, is that we start to putting more smarts into this. The major issue we see today is actually not self-driving pods or self-driving scooters. It's actually when you are not riding them. When you ride them, you're driving it. So why do you need, you know, actually, once you take the riding out of it, there's no fun anymore. So a lot of people, it seems to be not necessarily needed in this case, but when you're not riding them, there's tons of issue of how do you reorganize, rebalance these scooters? How do you charge them?
So that's how we see. There's just going to be fleets of scooters with nobody riding them, just roaming the streets.
That's right. Why not summon a scooter? So all these possibilities, I think it's really, you know, up for us to come up with technology and use our imaginations. And it's probably going to be room for many companies, not just us.
Okay. Do you ever come across things that you're like, no, this is too nuts, even for Segway? We would never make this.
Flying cars?
Okay.
Well, never say never, you know?
So no is the answer to my question.
Not in the horizon. We're not flying.
Fair enough. All right, awesome. And that's our show, everybody. Thanks to Tony, Christopher, and Joanna for being here. And thank you for listening and dealing with all of the strangeness of our location problems this week. As usual, we have new episodes on Fridays, so make sure you subscribe to Instant Message on whatever podcast app you use. As always, if you have feedback or ideas, email us at personaltech@wsj.com. We'll talk to you soon.